Hello and welcome to the University of California Press podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondek, and today I'll be speaking with Don Latin about his new book, Distilled Spirits, Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk. Don Latin is the author of The Harvard Psychedelic Club, How Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil Killed the 50s and Ushered in a New Age for America, Jesus Freaks, A True Story of Murder and Madness on the Evangelical Edge, and Following Our Bliss, How the Spiritual Ideals of the 60s Shape Our Lives Today, and Shopping for Faith, American Religion in the New Millennium.
Don Latin, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press podcast again.
My pleasure.
So this book follows really two tracks, the intersecting lives of the polymath Gerald Hurd, the essayist Aldous Huxley, and the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson. And then the second track is your personal struggles with substance abuse and spirituality. Was there a particular point in the writing process that you knew these two narratives would fit together?
Well, I actually did not start out with any intention to write a memoir, recovery memoir, spiritual memoir, any sort of memoir. My original idea for this book was a prequel to my previous book, which was the Harvard Psychedelic Club, which was a group biography of four other gentlemen in the 60s, Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, Houston Smith, and Andrew Weil, the psychedelic 60s. And that book sold pretty well, and I got two nice reviews in the New York Times. But I had a little bit of trouble getting big publishers interested in it. There were some more obscure characters, and I proposed the book to UC Press. And my editor there, Reed Malcolm, along with one of the outside reviewers of my book proposal, encouraged me to take a more personal approach to the book, which surprised me. I thought, well, this is a university press. They're going to want a more scholarly academic approach. Maybe they realize I'm not a scholar or an academic, so, so that might have something to do with it. But anyway, they encouraged me to write about myself and how these three lives helped me to better understand some of my own personal struggles. So the idea was to blend my memoir into the story of these three lives, which when I first thought about it, seemed very challenging, partly because I didn't personally know these three characters. I mean, they're actually my grandfather's generation. But as I started to do it, actually sat down and tried to recast the book in this with this blend of memoir and biography, it really started to flow. I mean, the opposite happened. It just really came together in an amazing way. I actually finished the manuscript 6 months early. I had a little initial hesitation because I worked for secular newspapers, for many years, and major metropolitan newspapers where, at least in the old days, I was a dirty word. You don't write about yourself. It's not about you. But once I got into it, actually, it really flowed, and it was liberating in a way.
So that's two of the men that you wrote about in the book. The third man, actually, I guess chronologically, the first, Gerald Hurd, I admit I'd never heard of him until I'd read your book before, and I got a sense that also part of your book is an attempt to bring Gerald Hurd maybe back into popular awareness. Could you talk a little bit about who he was and what he did?
Yeah, exactly. I actually start the book out by saying that you have probably never heard of Gerald Hurd, H-E-A-R-D, same spelling. But I think you should. I think the reader should, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book. He was a fascinating character. He was an Anglo-Irish mystic and philosopher, who along with Huxley was one of the last great polymaths. In an era of increasing specialization, these two guys were into absolutely everything. Hurd was, among other things, the first science correspondent for BBC Radio. He was really interested in reconciling science and religion. And very early on, way back in the 20s, he was writing books about what he saw as the potential for humanity to have kind of an evolutionary breakthrough in consciousness, which is an idea that, we are familiar with now because it's really the backbone of the so-called New Age movement, which isn't really all that new, but he, in some ways, he was the godfather of the New Age movement. He was kind of like the Wizard of Oz, the guy behind the curtain. And he influenced lots of people who went on to really make an impact later on in the 60s. I mean, people like Houston Smith, the scholar of world religions, and of course Huxley and Wilson. Also, Michael Murphy and Richard Price were the two guys who started the Esalen Institute out here in California on the on the coast, which was really the beginning of the human potential movement of the 1960s and 70s. They patterned Esalen. They met with a very elderly Mr. Hurd and were fascinated to hear about this retreat center he started in the 1940s in the Santa Ana Mountains south of Los Angeles called Chabuco College, which was an extraordinary place. There's a whole chapter about that in the book. So that was really one of the things that gave Murphy and Price the idea to start Esalen. So, you know, Hurd was into all kinds of things. He wrote, he must have written 40, 50 books, everything from like these deep philosophical tomes to weird mystery tales. I mean, he wrote this, one of his best-selling books was called A Taste of Honey, about this kind of evil beekeeper, and it was turned into a British horror movie called Those Deadly Bees. He wrote the first book about, popular book about flying saucers in the 1950s. He was a believer. He wrote some of the early, interesting early work on gay spirituality under a pseudonym, D.B. Vest, V-E-S-T, because he was a gay man. But, you know, most importantly for this book, he is the guy, like I said before, who got Huxley interested in spirituality and philosophy and religion, and got Bill Wilson interested in psychedelic drugs. So in the 50s, Gerald Hurd was kind of a proto-Timothy Leary. He didn't want everybody in the world to take psychedelics, but he was basically turning on a who's who of cultural figures back in the 1950s, including Henry Luce and his wife Claire Booth Luce. Henry Luce, of course, of the Time magazine empire, who tripped with Hurd. And it's interesting, if you go back and look at the coverage of the early psychedelic movement in Time and Life magazine, you have very, very positive stories. I think I figured out one reason for that. Henry Luce was simpatico.
Which was amazing to me, because Henry Luce was about the scariest Republican you could have come up with out of 1950s America.
Hurd was fairly conservative politically, too. So this really kind of transcended politics. You have to understand, you know, when we talk about LSD in the 1950s, you have to forget everything you think you know about LSD, because this was before Timothy Leary, it was before, you know, the Grateful Dead, tie-dye, the Haight-Ashbury, you know, all of that. At the time, LSD was, first of all, it was legal. It wasn't illegal until 1966. And it was seen as a promising new drug to help psychologists and other scientists understand the human mind, to understand both mental illness and more positive altered states of consciousness, spiritual experience. And there was all kinds of research going on, which there's a resurgence of now, lately actually. But back in the 50s, there was a first wave of this research trying to find a way to use psychedelic drugs to treat, say, depression, anxiety, and alcoholism, which was the reason that Bill Wilson first got interested in it.
In some ways, I thought this is actually also a book about California, and you can see how this locus, when I was reading the stuff about all the things that are going on in Los Angeles, I immediately started thinking of Kerry McWilliams' classic study of Southern California, where he talks about, for reasons that we've never really been able to be explained, the southern part of the state does tend to draw this kind of energy of people seeking to this stuff. But if you think your personal experience as a child of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and you mentioned that last answer, the Esalen Institute, it seemed as though that locus of looking for, I guess, expanded consciousness really shifted from, say, Southern California, particularly the Los Angeles area in the 40s and 50s, up into the Bay Area in the 60s and 70s. And that's still, I would say, to where most people think in popular consciousness, it still resides. Did you ever think about that North-South California connection while you're putting the book together?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, it is interesting that Huxley and Hurd came to the United States. Actually, they came on the same ship. They sailed on the SS Normandy in 1937, with no intention of staying the rest of their lives. It was going to be an extended vacation and a lecture tour. And they wound up settling in Los Angeles. You know, I say that these three guys, Wilson, Huxley, and Hurd, really helped transform the landscape of Western religion and spirituality. And that may seem like an overstatement, but I think I back it up in the book.
Carl Jung makes a very brief appearance in your book. And you talk about a situation in which he made the observation that, in his opinion, there was a particular tie between alcoholism and spirituality, which everybody who knows anything about AA knows that is a large part of the AA program, is belief in a higher power, not necessarily a Christian God, but there is something beyond you that you should be using, I guess, as a tool to reach sobriety. You were the religion reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. You've already mentioned that you had to develop, and often most reporters have to do, quite a degree of skepticism. But you were sitting in a seat, not only as a religion reporter, but probably in one of that one of the most fecund times for American spirituality in that area. So much was going on while you were sitting in the seat of the San Francisco Chronicle. When you began to confront your own substance abuse and your own questions of spirituality, how much of your reporter's instinct did you have find you had to claw through in order to get to those points that Wilson and Young talked about? Or I guess conversely, did you find that that was an accurate assessment for you, what Young and Wilson were talking about?
Well, first of all, the title of the book, Distilled Spirits, comes from a fairly famous letter, famous within AA circles, that Carl Jung, late in his life, wrote to Bill Wilson. Back in the 30s, there was a man by the name of Roland Hazard, who was a very wealthy East Coast gentleman who was basically drinking himself to death, and he went back to be treated for his alcoholism by, you know, the illustrious Dr. Jung. He had enough money to do that, and Jung told him that he thought the only thing that would really help him was a spiritual awakening. That was what he really needed to overcome his addiction and his self-centeredness. And so this guy, Roland Hazard, went back to the States, and he knew Bill Wilson and some of the early AA guys. And so he was an important figure in the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Jung had, in a way, a role in that. So decades later, Jung and Wilson are corresponding. And in this letter, Jung points out that the word in Latin, spiritus, refers to both a sublime religious experience and also refers to alcohol, which for the alcoholic, at least, can be a, you know, depraving poison. So for me, as a religion writer and an alcoholic, I find that very interesting. And, you know, a lot of the book and a lot of my life is, you know, about looking at the connections between the spiritual search and chemicals that produce altered states of consciousness. And for me, that really began not with alcohol, but with LSD. And I write in the book about, you know, some of the ecstasies and the agonies that I experienced, you know, back in the day with LSD, which is one of the things that got me interested in religious experience and in religion. It also left me because of, you know, both good and bad trips I had with kind of a combination of a fear and a fascination with religious experience. But it had something to do with me getting onto the religion beat as a reporter. But, you know, mainly I just got interested in that because it was a great story, especially as you mentioned in San Francisco back then. This was in the late 70s into the 80s, but it was still pretty interesting. And so I really went into it as a journalist. There was no one in San Francisco covering these stories. And so, you know, ultimately what I found is that writing about religion for a major metropolitan newspaper is basically hazardous to your spiritual health, partly because, you know, what we tend to do on newspapers is write about conflict and scandal. And, you know, there's no shortage in hypocrisy. There's no shortage of that in the world of organized religion. So if one of the things that you're struggling with is your own cynicism, this doesn't really help. So I don't think it's a coincidence that I started trying to change my life, both in terms of my sobriety and my spirituality, when I really left the paper, which was in 2006, which is about the same time I got serious about sobering up.
My sense from the book is, as you mentioned, really back in the 50s, a man like Gerald Hurd didn't think everybody should be turned on. And in the experience you talk about in the 50s, they were very controlled experiences. There always seemed to be people there. It seemed very clinical. Whereas opposed to the 1960s, and this might be some of the things you talked about in your other book, they're almost went from being professional to amateur hour. As long as you take the, you know, everybody can make it, perhaps in a strange way, almost the Protestant Reformation of psychedelia. You know, your relationship with psychedelia isn't what the doctors say. You go out and find it on your own. But do you think that reaction from the 60s ended up maybe helping us throw the baby out with the bathwater with regards to hallucinogenics, that people got so scared of what they were seeing as individuals out there with no help taking these things and having some pretty bad experiences, that all of the positive stuff that maybe people found in the 50s from a therapeutic point of view was just dismissed?
Yeah, no, there definitely was a backlash to the 60s. I mean, there's no doubt about it. You know, in the 1950s, this research was being done, and it was being done in a very, for the most part, in a very cautious manner. You had, trained, psychiatrists, psychologists leading this research, medical supervision. More importantly, of course, you knew exactly what you were taking and what the dose was. I mean, this was pharmaceutical LSD, manufactured by Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland. And, Huxley, for instance, and Hurd too, but Huxley, for instance, Huxley would never talk about psychedelics on television because he thought that the general public really couldn't understand it. And both he and Hurd, their idea was to basically introduce the drug, to cultural, artistic leaders, to writers and painters and philosophers and scholars, and kind of a trickle-down effect of the psychedelic consciousness. Whereas Leary had and Richard Alpert, who became the spiritual teacher Ram Dass, had a completely different idea. I mean, they thought, and they weren't saying necessarily everyone should take LSD, but they thought it was an issue of cognitive freedom, that everyone has the right to play around with their own consciousness. And, so the whole turn on, tune in, drop out thing of the 60s became largely because of the whole youth movement that was happening then, this demographic, the baby boomers, demographic bulge, everyone's coming of age in the 60s, and then economic prosperity, and, people had the freedom and the numbers behind them to do some pretty wild exploration. And so, we all know what happened in the 60s, and there were a lot of casualties, from drugs, including psychedelic drugs. And Richard Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America. These drugs were put on, Schedule I drugs, which meant you couldn't even do research. I mean, legitimate academic research with them. And so this backlash really continued into the 1990s, and it's only now that we're seeing, I just wrote a magazine article about this, we're seeing a whole new wave of research into finding beneficial uses for these substances, not just LSD, but also psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in so-called magic mushrooms, which is what Leary started out with, and also MDMA, which is known as ecstasy on the street. There's some interesting research and encouraging, hopeful research going on at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere using ecstasy to treat returning Iraqi and Afghan war vets suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, along with therapy and helping them to try to understand these fears. So there's all kinds of research going on right now. So I think they did throw the baby out with the bathwater, but the baby's finally grown up, and there's some real interesting work going on right now.
Don Latton, the author of Distilled Spirits, Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk. Thanks so much for being on the University of California Press podcast today.
Thank you, Chris.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu. Don't forget, you can find the University of California Press on Facebook, www.facebook.com/UCPress, or you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the University of California Press podcast. Copyright 2012, the University of California Press, all rights reserved.